Hello, Internet. This is David Rovix with another episode of Discussions with David, which is a live, which is live streamed most weekdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT. We are broadcasting at davidrovix.com/quarantine on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KBOO Community Radio, as well as via my channels on YouTube, Periscope, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn. You can find all of these discussions archived on my YouTube channel in the Discussions with David playlist and in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform or go to davidrovix.com. If you have any suggestions for future guests on my show or if you are involved in some way with a social media account, that might be a good place from which to live stream my discussions. I'm very interested in guest suggestions and I have the capacity to add additional platforms to the broadcast. When you poke around online, looking at the many years of activism and popular education that today's guest has been involved with, it would be easy to read the various references and conclude that Margaret Flowers wears many hats. But once you scratch the surface, it's very easy to see that all these hats were cut from the same cloth. My most vivid recollections of seeing Margaret in action was at Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., where she and other wonderful folks were pillars of the Freedom Plaza edition of Occupy Wall Street back in the fall of 2011. I visited scores of Occupy encampments across North America that fall, and Freedom Plaza was easily one of the most dynamic and well-organized centers of resistance during that period. Also, one of the few encampments that featured a sound system, which pleased this particular musician greatly. But becoming ensconced in Occupy Wall Street and co-founding Popular Resistance, whose Facebook page we are, as I mentioned earlier, broadcasting on, was only one more logical step in a trajectory that long predates Occupy Wall Street, when Margaret was a practicing pediatrician making the painful discovery that in order to effectively serve the public as a doctor, it was first necessary to radically transform the political and economic system that governs the United States, which she set out to do as an advocate for universal health care and later in a run for the Senate in Maryland. Margaret Flowers, welcome to my little live stream show.
Oh, thank you for
joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me, David. I'm a big fan, so it's great to be with you.
Very mutual. Reading about you as I've been doing for the past couple of hours this morning, I sort of cram before the interviews, but my impression is that the older you get, the more radical you get. Is that kind of the trajectory, would you say, or is it, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, how can you not? The more that you see, the more that you understand the root causes of the systems that are causing the problems that we have, you know, you definitely become more radical. I think that's just a natural occurrence.
Was there, just before we discuss a bit about the present moment, was there in your lifetime a light bulb moment when you realized, like, this is not, that things need to change in this society?
Oh, gosh. I think it was a series of light bulb moments, you mm-hmm. know, first as a practicing doc and kind of seeing how the system was not set up for healthcare or health. And then just the more you get in, you know, the experiences in Congress, this experiences traveling, reading, it just gets clearer and clearer.
And I know you've written a lot recently about the pandemic, and also you shared this wonderful lengthy article by a Bulgarian doctor, which I understood about half of, and I was really glad that you were sort of digesting it for us in the introduction. But I wonder, it just strikes me at how at a moment like this with what we're dealing with, there are so many areas of expertise that are particularly useful to trying to understand what is going on and how the response is happening and how it should be happening. But I'm just you have particular perspective as a doctor, and I know it's a constantly fast moving situation. And for those people out there, which include many people out there who are actually keeping very close track of developments, I wonder if you have any thoughts on just what's been going on in the past week in terms of discoveries about how things are going or the understanding of the trajectory of this situation in the U.S. and opening up and what's that going to lead to.
Oh gosh, there's a lot to unpack
it's
there.
A lot. I know. I know. It's hard to know where do you start. So just, you know, feel free to be overwhelmed. But it's a big question. But
I mean, first off, I think it's important for folks to understand that this is a new coronavirus. It's something that humans have not experienced before, you know, because people are like, oh, well, it's just another coronavirus, which is typically a cold virus. Why should we be worried about this? But this is a whole new strain that humans have never seen. And, you know, when something like that occurs and it becomes clear that it's being transmitted easily from person to person and that some people are getting extremely sick with it, you know, you have to take that seriously until you know that it's, you know, safe to not take it seriously. So I think China was really smart and, you know, once they kind of figured out what was going on, taking really important steps, which people called draconian at the time, but you look back on it and it actually worked and they were able to start reopening their economy. Although now they're having, you know, another outbreak. They continue to be vigilant and they're testing 11 million people in 10 days in the city of Wuhan. And they've also put, you know, restrictions on movement in another area. So, you know, I think this is just something that we should have learned from. And instead, the United States did like everything wrong and didn't take it seriously, didn't get tests out there, didn't, you know, really do a good public education or even clear messaging to the public and health professionals about what they should be doing. So I hear from a lot of my doctor and nurse friends that they are just like getting confusing messages all the time. I think what we're learning is that this is a virus that really has serious impacts on the body and on a number of different organ systems. So it's not just the lungs, but it's the heart, the liver, the GI tract, the nervous system. It's causing blood clots and, you know, its impacts on the vascular system. And it's having long-term consequences. And so, you know, it's not something to take lightly. I think that, you know, we're also learning that people like in South Korea are relapsing from the infection. So they seem to have cleared it and then they get sent home and then it builds back up in their system and they get sick again. We're also seeing its impacts on children, which is really distressing. I treated a number of children with Kawasaki syndrome when I was a practicing physician. And back then we really didn't have any idea what the cause was at all. We were like, is it chemicals in the carpet? You know, we just really didn't know. And now they're starting to tie that to coronaviruses. And we're seeing this Kawasaki type syndrome in kids who have had COVID-19 and they're thinking it might be related to that. And that's something that has serious, it makes children very sick and it can have long lasting impacts on their hearts as well. So I think this is something we should really be taking seriously. And this idea of places reopening to me is incredibly scary. We're already seeing increases in cases in places like North Carolina and Georgia, you know, which have done started to open up some. And we do not have the systems in place to be doing this in a safe way. Or even people, I think it's reassuring that most people, when they're polled, are supporting steps to control the spread. But there's still this kind of really vocal small group that's out there just pushing the wrong ideas, I think.
It's, yeah, and the it seems like the basic attitude, I mean, when China took these massive steps and showed what a well-organized central government could do to deal with a pandemic, I was like so many others watching that with fascination, but then I was so not expecting the United States to be able to mount any kind of response like that, that my attitude at the beginning of this, of course, not knowing, of course, you know, how bad the illness was or anything like that, my attitude was very much like the right wingers who are saying, well, just, you know, screw it. We'll just, you know, go on with life, because I thought they're not going to mount a response to this. So we're just going to, people who are going to die are going to die. And that's how it's America. You know, hopefully we can change that someday, you know. But then when the governments of Europe and then ultimately the United States did this kind of shutdown, despite the lack of other competent response, like having any kind of a testing regimen in place in the US or anything like that, it was still, I was completely shocked that the capitalists were capable of shutting down capitalism even for a day. I don't know, did this surprise you, or did you, as somebody who understands the concept of exponential spread, maybe you just thought, well, this had to happen, it was inevitable?
Yeah, I mean, we actually started isolating ourselves before there was any of the call for isolation, but I actually got sick early on, March 2nd, I guess. Yeah, I think it was around March 2nd. We had been in New York for a week, a little over a week before that. We were at a conference, and then my partner Kevin's mother, who's 91, was hit by a motorcycle when she was crossing the street and fractured her pelvis, and we had to stay up there to, you know, make sure that she was taken care of. She's doing great now, by the way. She's amazing. But so when we got home a few days after that, I started to feel bad and then got a full-blown illness. And so we were pretty much locking ourselves down because I couldn't get tested. Our health department wouldn't test me at that point. They had tested, right. They refused to test me. And so I think that the early numbers that people were seeing, estimating 1 million, 2 million deaths, I think that really scared the capitalists. I think if they could have gotten away with it, they probably wouldn't have done anything. But I was surprised, but saddened that we don't have a centralized response. And so it was done really ineffectively. And I just feel like this is going to be a really prolonged problem in the United States because they're not doing the right thing. But my take was, we should, you know, I was really glad to see people just doing it, just, you know, despite not having this direction, just taking measures to protect themselves and other people. And then the mutual aid that's been going on is really tremendous. And I think this is really important as a building block towards what we need to do to create the society that we want, right? So more power to individual actions to help each other out. And
yeah, absolutely. Although the kind of, mutual aid is a wonderful thing, and communities responding is a wonderful thing, but the kind of national response that's really necessary with the kind of testing they're doing in Wuhan and places like that to actually open up safely and this sort of thing is just not even anywhere close to the reality in the United States, right? And we're going to be dealing with mutual aid in the face of a lot of people dying.
I think we need to be constantly calling for, and we keep putting this message out from Popular Resistance, that it's not a choice between the economy and our health. What we need to be saying is we want both, that we need to be demanding of our governments at every level, local, state, federal, that they do put these structures in place and that they put the economic supports in place. You know, we should be covering everybody's health care right now. We should be providing a basic income to everyone. We should be protecting our workers, you know, our especially our essential workers, you know, in all sorts of areas that we need. And this is also, you know, that the doctor from, the article that you mentioned, you know, Bulgaria,
The Bulgarian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He also, you know, put forth the idea that pandemics are here, you know, with the climate crisis, and the way that we're doing land development and encroaching into wild spaces. Pandemics are here. We need to be able to have a structure so we can pause the economy when we need to protect public health. So I hope that people will be, you know, using this time to push for those ideas.
Right. And then it's such a time to push for those ideas because the pandemic has exposed how important having a public health sector is, having a public health system that's actually intended to serve the public. Because when it comes down to it, it's like I feel like I'm living in some kind of a I don't know, it's so surreal, it's hard to even, you know, describe. But like when people, you hear Americans talking about, well, I have healthcare, I have this healthcare package, this, you know, whatever they're calling it these days, HMO, they fantasize that actually means something, like because of course it seems like they're not even processing the fact that, well, in the face of a pandemic, your whatever healthcare you think you have is just a fantasy, because it's the whole society that's facing this problem, and the only solution is a societal solution, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is, you know, pandemics don't know any borders, and they don't know class. They impact everybody, and as long as the infection is out there. And this is something that we've been pushing for a long time, as we pushed for a single payer healthcare system, is that none of us are safe if, You know, if people are in our communities and they, particularly if they catch infectious diseases, that puts everyone at risk. But, you know, just morally, you don't want anybody, and nobody should go without healthcare. That's just, it's a completely inhumane and cruel way to treat people. We do that every day in the United States.
But that's what we do here, inhumane and cruel. No healthcare, and then millions living on the streets with no healthcare, which is a whole other level. And then that is creating a public health crisis in every major American city, isn't it? That with having thousands of people living in tents without sanitation in the center of places like Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, Oakland, New York, this is a public health crisis all by itself. Is it not?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, here where I live in Baltimore, when the pandemic first began, we tried to organize quickly. A lot of groups in Baltimore came together, you know, pushing to get people who were without housing into hotel rooms, apartments. Baltimore actually owns a whole convention hotel that was shut down, which they could have put all the homeless into, and they still. You know, we had some council members that were supportive, but they're still only just doing it for people who test positive, which is ridiculous. We should be protecting people from testing positive, not waiting until they do. But it was an interesting story where in one of the public housing communities, a leader there contacted me and said, we don't have food. The stores are price gouging. Milk and eggs are like three times the price of what they should be. And the state had put out an anti-price gouging, you know, law or whatever order, and they reported it, but nothing was being done. So we started collecting food and brought, you know, a couple of carloads of food down to them. And when she went to hand it out in the community, the housing authority came down and threatened her. They threatened to call the police, but the police wouldn't come because they knew her. She's a real figure in that community. And then they threatened her with eviction. And so we pushed back and, you know, documented it, got media attention for it. And the mayor actually had to back down, wrote a letter to the housing authority, said she can pass out food if she wants to. And it got all of this media attention. And so all these groups started bringing in food. And now she's feeding three public housing communities in her area every day. She's giving out foods and cleaning supplies and teaching, you know, about how to protect, you know, people to protect themselves, and it's had a real impact. So,
but Baltimore City that owns a hotel convention center, and it's still closed and not occupied by people that need housing currently right now.
Yeah, they gave us this stuff about well, then we have to have workers staffing it.
And yeah. What's the problem there?
The city's got this huge amount of money that they, you know, then their rainy day fund. Well, what constitutes a rainy day of a pandemic? Does it, you know?
Yeah, if this isn't a rainy day fund, time to use such a fund. But my impression is that this is also happening all over the place. Obviously, like I was talking on this program with Keith McHenry a couple weeks ago in Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
And he actually, he sold his house in New Mexico and used the money to house the homeless in hotel rooms in Santa Cruz, which is obviously not a sustainable thing to do, but nobody else was doing it. So he stepped up and actually paid for, I don't know how many hotel rooms to try to empty out the shelters, which are just obviously disease breeding centers, which they have been for, you know, everybody knows that. If it was ever been living on the streets, you know, the last place you want to go is one of those shelters.
Exactly.
But this is the same in Santa Cruz, where it's an incredibly wealthy place. It's unbelievable. It's dripping with wealth, that town. And yet they can't house the homeless in all of these hotel rooms, which are completely vacant because, of course, there's nobody taking vacations or anything. But it's the precedent this would set, isn't it? I mean, we live in a society where people live on the streets, and to show that they could be housed so easily would just be too threatening to the capitalist status quo. Real estate is investment. Housing's not a right. That would be, turn everything upside down here, wouldn't it?
Right. I mean, places like Salt Lake City actually did a housing first approach in their community. But yeah, I mean, Baltimore, we've been complaining for a long time. We have 40,000 abandoned units, housing units in Baltimore City, enough for many times more for each person. And they're being bought up and flipped, basically. There were some students that did a study on that at the school of social work. And, you know, we could easily be housing everybody in Baltimore. When I moved here in the early 80s, they had a program where if you bought a house, an abandoned house, you could buy it for $5 if you agreed to fix it up and live in it for at least 5 years. And that's what a lot of my medical school friends did. That's the way that they got a place to live when they came here.
Yeah. And I could see, like, I think it's just a fascinating thing to me, and I think to others, that your the trajectory of your sort of activism going kind of from the medical to the economic in a way. It's like it's very natural, because obviously, yeah, if people aren't housed, this is a crisis. And then you have to take on this whole question of, like, well, why is the housing market like that? Now, how is that? And then it comes down to an analysis of, well, okay, so this whole capitalist system is the problem here, that's not taking human needs into account. And yet, but you have traveled quite extensively around the world, quite a lot. And I know you have travel plans that were destroyed by the pandemic for better or for worse, but you have seen other countries where things are done differently. And I wonder just if you could share any insights about that. I mean, I'm often talking about Denmark, because Denmark is a place that I spend a lot of time, and it's not paradise, but it sure looks like paradise when you're coming from here.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, Venezuela is a country that is remarkable for what they're doing, and considering the, you know, economic war that the United States has been waging against them, as well as, you know, direct interference in their elections and threats of military aggression and actual military aggression. But yet they have put in place a structure, you know, over the past 20 years of creating these community councils where they make decisions for what they need in their community and in a very democratic way. And then they apply to the government to get support for that. We were going into some of the barrios that didn't have any resources, water, electricity, transportation before Chavez was elected. And now they have new schools and community agriculture and health clinics everywhere you saw, and dental clinics and buses. And so, you know, and water. And they've built 3 million units of affordable housing, of social housing, which in the United States, so they have a tenth of our population. And we have 1.1 million units of social housing in the US, and they have 3 million that they built in, you know, recent years. And so you couldn't find anywhere. And I looked, and we were out at all hours looking. I looked for people that were homeless. I didn't see any signs of it. And, you know, they didn't have everything because of the economic war, but they had enough, and they, you know, they just dealt with it. And they're growing food everywhere. Everybody's so excited about the food they're growing. They have a whole ministry of urban agriculture that just works to help people grow food. And they take urban space, all kinds of space, and garden. And
is that, you know, the urban gardening, is that a recent phenomenon, or that's been going on there a long time as well?
I don't know that it's been a long time. You know, I didn't ask her about that. We met with the minister of urban agriculture and toured around with her, and she's just awesome, great energy. And she's mostly focused on youth, teaching youth to grow food. And
Great. Because I noticed when I was in Cuba in 99, they had taken up a whole lot of urban agriculture, and that was kind of there was this green belt outside of Havana that I guess was a fairly recent addition to the geography, and it didn't used to be there until the special period of the 90s. But,
well, you know, about 2014 or so, when the oil prices really crashed, I think they were able, and they really didn't have a lot of economic sanctions at that time. It got worse under Obama and under Trump. I think they were able to purchase a lot. And that, I think that's the problem with having like a lot of resources like Venezuela does, is for a long time they could just buy what they needed. And so they're having to really work to produce what they need.
Yeah, it's a big shift. The same kind of, in a sense, the same kind of shift Cuba had to deal with after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Although Venezuela never was able to benefit from that. This is all much later with Venezuela, but the UK, I believe, has been intercepting medical aid that's been going to Venezuela. The US and UK have been doing this interception of medical aid, which I think is
Right now, there's Iranian tankers full of oil on their way to Venezuela because they can't get parts to repair their refinery.
So they have to import oil.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. They have the number one oil reserves in the world. And the U.S. is surrounding Venezuela right now with the Navy. And sadly, I learned today that they're harassing the fishermen, or the women, the fisher people. I think it's probably in retaliation because they were the first line that you know, stopped this military invasion that the mercenaries were trying in Venezuela earlier this month, and now the U.S. Navy is harassing them. It's just disgusting.
It's disgusting, and it's also fascinating that these people, like in the U.S. government and others from, I guess, some elements of the Venezuelan expat community, I don't know who these people are necessarily, but there are people who are always, just like in 1961 with the Bay of Pigs invasion, there are people under the impression that the Venezuelan government is like some kind of a house of cards and totally unpopular, and that all they need is 100 guys with guns to go in and they're going to foment a revolution. And, you know, that they're so wrong about that, and they get intercepted by fishermen. Like,
right. Well, Venezuela has a really interesting, and we met some of them. They have a 4 million person civilian militia organizing since President Trump started making military threats, and so they're very astute. They're very. I mean, the political education down there is so admirable. Like, I wish we had that in the United States. People down there understand what's going on, and they see what's happening, and they can put it into the bigger context of U.S. imperialism. And so they're just really savvy about this. And I think that's a big reason why they've been able to resist all the efforts that the U.S. has thrown at them. And I think they will continue to resist. I mean, it's sadly that we keep trying.
And it's really something to see when you're actually in a place that has such a mobilized population, mobilized into neighborhood groups and community groups that are so actively advocating for their own local projects and interests and for each other's projects. And it makes you realize all the false propaganda about this. They try to paint countries like that as dictatorships, and people like Maduro or Chavez or Castro as these dictators that everybody hates. And yet they never tell you about how Fidel Castro used to drive around the country without any security at all. Mm-hmm. And never had a problem with that.
Yeah. The U.S. was trying to kill him constantly.
Yeah, even I mean, maybe he was foolish to be going around without security, but still.
He survived, you know.
Yeah. Oh, a very long time. Yeah. Margaret, can you tell me about the Green Shadow Cabinet? I had never heard of that phrase before, but I've heard the phrase from the UK where they talk about the shadow. Every time there's a government like the Conservatives or the Labour is in power, the other party has what they call a shadow cabinet, which is a wonderful concept, I think, for a more grassroots level. And tell us about
that. It's not active anymore, but this came out of Jill Stein's run for president as the Green Party candidate in 2012. And I was supportive of her running then. And she was talking about wanting to kind of, during the campaign, put together this kind of cabinet, like these are the people who would be in my cabinet and be able to like talk about issues. And so when, after the election, we thought, well, we need to keep the conversation going about these issues. We can't let it go. So we decided to create a green shadow cabinet and brought in about, it was hundreds of people that were in that, I think, I can't remember now, but we also created positions that, you know, that we wanted to see. So Department of Peace, and Lee Camp was the head of like political comedy or something, you know, because you have to make fun of kind of what's going on. Oh,
there definitely needs to be a head of political economy, comedy. That should definitely be a cabinet position.
And, you know, human rights, Ajama Baraka was human rights, and David Swanson was peace. And it was just a way to, what we wanted to do was whatever was happening politically that we could get responses out quickly of alternatives, you know, like this is what we should be doing, this is what we could be doing, kind of thing. And so that was what that was about.
Great.
Yeah.
Popular resistance. I mean, one of the things that's been coming up quite a lot on the website and the email list and everything has been updates on general strike and rent strike activities. And cool as the internet is for being able to network with people from around the world, it's not so helpful, it seems, in sort of gauging the mood on the street, you know, when there's nobody on the streets. And I don't know, some people are maybe better at it than others, but do you have any, what's your impression about the state of affairs with rent strikes, general strikes that popular resistance has been encouraging?
Well, you know, it's something that we're hoping we can foster and grow in the United States, because, you know, we see the pandemic has exposed so much. I mean, just in like every issue, it's exposed the dysfunction in the United States. And so there's, you know, this is really an opportune time for us to push for the changes that we need and not just, you know, say, take little crumbs. Like, I've always been opposed to taking crumbs because that allows them to just hand out more crumbs. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, be what we need, right? And so this is really an opportunity where we could do that. And so we learned about this kind of effort. We had kind of seen it floating out there and didn't think much about it. It was just some tweets and things like that. But then we talked to Kali Akuno, who runs Cooperation Jackson and is connected with a lot of workers in the South. And he said, oh, no, this is something, you know, we're trying to organize and see it as a regular campaign that builds, that people can participate in all different ways. And coming out with a set of demands that we need. And then, you know, the only way that we're going to get things met is through resistance. And it doesn't actually take the whole country. You know, what you need to win change is you need a majority of people in the country to support what you're fighting for. And then you need a small, you know, 3-5, maybe 5% of people who are actually mobilized and exerting pressure on the system in an effective way. And so we saw this general strike campaign as a way to try to build that, and people can participate in different ways, from not paying their rent and organizing in their communities, which I think you're doing, to, you know, workers striking, to taking collective action once a month, to not paying debts, to not shopping, you know, all the things that we can do to kind of withhold our support for this system. And so, you know, it's something we're trying to build, and we're doing monthly calls on it and trying to find ways that we can participate and support this kind of an effort. But it's, you know, it's just something we need to do, I think.
We need to do it. Whether or not it works, it's necessary. I mean, this is the one of the things that always comes up, it seems, when, I mean, historically and in very recent history and going further back, is whenever there are people calling for things like strikes of any kind, but rent strikes, to take that as a particular example, there's always going to be some people saying, well, what's going to happen when you lose? You're going to get evicted, and then you're never going to find another place to live again, and you'll be blacklisted. And, you know, it's so irresponsible to be encouraging rent strikes, I get told now and then, although most of the reactions to what I'm doing are very positive, because, you know, most people think differently because they realize that it's a desperate situation and they may themselves be in a desperate situation. And even if they can pay the rent now, they don't know what the situation will be in a few months when this, for those of us who, which does not include me, who actually have started getting unemployment money from the state after applying for it 2 months ago, you know, that's going to run out anyway, you know, and then what, you know, because the pandemic isn't going to suddenly end, and borders aren't going to be open, and all these gig economy workers who used to do whatever we did, like in my case, touring around and playing music to packed crowds of people in small, sweaty little places, you know, that's hard to imagine that resuming anytime soon. And I'm sure the unemployment will not last beyond that if it's the way it is now. But but we can push for things to be done differently. And we have examples of, as our economy is collapsing, and what they say, Forbes is estimating 42% of the jobs that have been lost are not going to be regained as of yesterday. They say that, but then we have other examples in the world where they've suspended rent payments and deferred mortgages, which is not not an overthrow of capitalism. Doesn't do away with real estate speculation, but it sure helps with the current problem in a very big way. Yeah. But it seems to be too much to expect our government to do a long-term suspension of rents or deferment of mortgages unless they're pushed to do that. And what could that pushing look like? I mean, some people will say that everything needs to be totally organized. And if everybody's withholding rent money, it all needs to go into some account and there needs to be this kind of structure. But then I'm not sure if that's at all necessary. If it's an idea that a lot of people are participating in, it can spread like ideas can spread. I wonder what you think about organizing strategies for this.
Yeah, I don't think movements work that way, where people just like tell other people what to do and everybody does it. I mean, we didn't tell people to go on rent strikes. We were just amplifying what people were already doing in their communities because, like you said, they don't really have a choice. They can't pay their rent. They've lost their job. They're not getting unemployment. And housing should be a right. And this is the time to really say that, you know, are we really going to do another 2008 and evict all of these people from their homes so these speculators can buy them up and rent them out at, you know, exorbitant prices? This is to see what that does to people. So we really just believe that, you know, movements are something that kind of develop when the conditions are right. And our role at Popular Resistance has been to try to connect things as much as possible, to help people feel like they're all part of a fight, of a common fight. Because we're not going to win like one thing and not win the other things. It just doesn't work that way. We're never going to get a single payer healthcare system without actually changing the whole paradigm and understanding that we have rights that are being violated and the government can and does have the responsibility to protect those rights. So, you know, it's for us with the whole general strike campaign, it's exciting because people can participate in so many different ways. And if they just all feel like one powerful force, then, you know, that I think can be really effective. So, yeah.
Yeah. This idea of the governing requires, at least to some degree, the consent of the governed. Huh? I mean, it seems like changing people's minds is so much of the battle in terms of understanding that society can be different, that a different world is actually possible.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the kind of the three things that you need to accomplish in a successful movement is that people have to recognize there's a problem. They have to understand that the current system won't fix the problem. And then they have to support an alternative vision. So we have to put forward that alternative vision. And I think there's already wide support for a lot of the things that people are pushing for. Housing, healthcare, education, job protection, you know, pensions, things like that. And so I just lost my train of thought.
But, oh, good. You do that too?
I'm getting old.
It's a sign of brilliance.
Oh, my brain is too full. But yeah, so this is the time for us really, I think, to put forward this vision. Oh, I know what it was. It was, you know, our philosophy is that when the people lead, the leaders will follow. And mm-hmm. you see it, you know, in Medicare for All, we were pushing for years and years to get that to be on the agenda. And then because people were building support, Bernie Sanders saw that as an opportunity to run on for his political platform, just like we built the campaign to stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And Trump saw that as the perfect thing to pick up. Like, who thought that Trump was actually going to win that campaign for us? None of us. Yeah. Saw that coming, but, you know, and of course, even Hillary Clinton had to come out and say that she opposed it after she'd been supporting it for all those years. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how it works. And so if people understood the power that we actually have to shift the national dialogue and move political leaders because they have to get elected and, you know, they
to shift that paradigm.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I remember reading in Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States how in order to promote World War I to the U.S. population, the federal government hired 75,000 high school teachers to travel around the country and make speeches advocating for war.
Wow.
But that they needed to have that kind of propaganda machine in order to get any kind of popular participation, despite the fact that they had instituted a draft. Mm-hmm. And then even with the draft, I don't know the statistic for the U.S., but in Canada, 50% of draft age men were medically exempt, which I think tells us something about the opposition to the war, but also about the terrible state of health of Canadians at the time. And mm-hmm. maybe in the face of, I don't know, well, the pandemic came later, but after that pandemic in 1918, 1919, you know, the leadership of the labor movement in Winnipeg, where the big general strike, first big general strike in North America at the time happened, was they were not at all confident that there was any possibility of victory, but everybody was just half starved and from the conditions at the time and ready to all walk off the job. And it was there another case of the leaders following the people and then decided, okay, well, we're going to do our best to lead this general strike because it's happening anyway.
Right. I mean, we didn't get the New Deal because they benevolent leaders thought they would give us to it. There was, you know, tremendous amount of action going on at that time, workers, all kinds of things.
I remember another thing in Zinn's book about the New Deal. It was in 1931, the year before the New Deal was instituted, there were 500 documented incidents of 100 or more people with guns liberating the contents of warehouses. Mm. And they kept track of these kinds of events.
Yeah, there were 500. And there was a bonus march, you know, where the veterans walked all the way to Washington, D.C. from all across the country and set up a camp there. And one of the things they did that I think is such a powerful in these, they wanted their bonus that they were promised because of the Depression. And they would do this death march around the Capitol, just silently, veterans just silently walking around the Capitol day after day.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then the first use of tanks by the U.S. military was there in Washington, D.C. Right. to fire into the camp.
And Eisenhower, I think, was it those? I know it was Patrick. It was MacArthur. Oh, I can't remember now.
Yeah, guys who became really well known.
Yeah. Wait, Kevin's telling me.
Oh, good. Good to have an expert around nearby.
Pat MacArthur and Eisenhower. And they actually... the bonus marchers had moved a lot of the women and children across the Anacostia River, where they thought that they wouldn't come. And they went across that bridge and attacked them in any way there. And that was just really exposed things to people and I think shifted things for quite a while.
And it took years from the massacre of the bonus marchers, the burning down of their camp, the hundreds of incidents of small-scale armed uprisings throughout the country, and so much else before finally, when FDR was elected, they started passing this kind of legislation. But notably, in the past couple months, it all happened much, much faster than that, which was again kind of interesting to me because, first of all, I didn't expect that the capitalists would be able to shut down capitalism for any reason, even for, public health, or even if though, rich people were dying of this disease and too. But I still didn't expect them to be able to do that. And nor did I expect this kind of response. But it's quick bailout of not only corporations, but also of the people. I mean, I got my check. And if I didn't get that check, I don't know. Well, I mean, I don't know what our finances would be like. And for so many other people in this country, that check might have been the difference between who knows what and who knows what. I don't know. But it came quickly. It didn't take 3 years.
Yeah, well, it shows they can do it. And I think that is one of the biggest lessons that people have seen is like, oh, well, you actually can mobilize all this money very quickly. I mean, we've seen it forever for the military industrial complex. I've been plenty of hearings of the armed services in the Senate where they just ask for more money and the committee says, sure. But I even stood up one time because I was so disgusted by that. And I went up to the front of the senators and said, well, why can't you do that for education and healthcare and the things that we actually need?
And then you got arrested?
They didn't arrest me that time. They just removed me, which was...
Removed you?
Yeah.
You didn't look quite like the arrestable type. Oh, she's a doctor.
I stood up a few times there. I stood up once when they bombed the hospital, the Doctors Without Borders hospital in Afghanistan. And then the general in charge of Afghanistan, Campbell, was testifying. And I went down with some others and had my white coat and stood up before the hearing started. And I just said, bombing hospitals is a war crime. And then I needed to get back home because I had work to do. So I wasn't going to stay for the whole hearing. I left the room and John McCain apparently ordered my arrest and they came out and caught me in the hallway and dragged me off, which was a drag.
He's sensitive about bombing hospitals. He's been responsible for bombing too many hospitals. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But we're off track. Anyway, people know now that we can do these things. And so, and $1,200 one time is nowhere near sufficient. Canada's giving $2,000 a month to every adult until the end of the pandemic. And we should demand the same thing.
Nice to have an example of that so nearby. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Margaret, when you guys started the encampment at Freedom Plaza in DC, which was a wonderful little liberated zone for a while there, you were actually planning on taking over Freedom Plaza before Occupy Wall Street started. Do I recall that correctly?
Can
you just tell that little story about how that happened and what that was about? Because it was really quite something, and people. I don't know. People keep on coming across imagery from Freedom Plaza on YouTube and seeing little shots of concerts and speeches and stuff. And I don't know if most of the people watching the YouTube videos know what they're watching exactly. But what was happening in Freedom Plaza in 2011? Yeah.
Well, it was interesting because it actually started in like December of 2010. After the healthcare law passed in 2010, I was traveling around the country a lot working with people because they were all saying, you know, what do we do now in the single payer movement? We pushed so hard. And it really became apparent that we needed to connect these issues. And I wanted to be an example of how do we connect issues. And so in December, Chris Hedges reached out to me and he said, I'm going to do this action at the White House, this anti-war action. I'm going to risk arrest. Will you be my jail support? And I said, sure. And then I thought about it for about a week and I was like, you know what? Can I, as a physician, also participate in this and make connections between the anti-war movement and the struggle for healthcare? And they said, sure. So Kevin was our jail support. And hundreds of us, it was an amazing day because the snow came down. We weren't expecting that. It was a Thursday and hundreds of people showed up, most of them veterans. And we did this very powerful action. 132 of us were arrested in front of the White House. And it turned out Obama was inside. Talking about Afghanistan at the same time we were outside. He was doing a press conference and he was Perfect. Like, oh, surge is working. It's great. And we're out there getting arrested. So after that, we were like, well, we want to keep this going. And so we started meeting in New York, bringing groups together and saying, well, you know, these symbolic protests that don't do anything they're not effective. We need to actually be developing a resistance. And what would that look like? And at the time, you know, we were starting to see the Arab Spring and what was happening in Madison, Wisconsin. And we went out there for a few days to talk to folks and learn more about that. And we were in touch with the Indignados in Spain and with people in Egypt. And, you know, we decided we wanted to occupy space as well. So we started organizing. We did kind of a test action in New York in April on tax day where we were wondering if we could get groups who work on different issues to come together and do a common action. And so we did that and targeting Bank of America for getting like billions of dollars of tax refund and saying, well, this is what we want our tax money to go for. Instead, we created our own little like town of what it would look like with single payer healthcare and green jobs and all this. And we took over this Bank of America and people that, enthusiasm was so high. We ended up taking over the whole lobby of this bank outside Union Square that had these big glass windows and just playing music in there and giving speeches and singing, and people were very empowered. And so we were like, yeah, we can do this on a bigger scale. And we started organizing to occupy Freedom Plaza. And so that was months of really intense, literally 7 in the morning till 1 a.m. just organizing. And we had about 100 person team nationwide, all kinds of committees, and just trying to give people confidence that this was something they could participate in and get the word out. And so then Occupy Wall Street announced in July, but there were also other efforts. There were other groups that were thinking about organizing these types of things, and they decided, some of them, well, we'll fold into what you're doing because, you know, you seem to have some legs to what you're doing. But it was kind of just in the air that everybody.
This whole concept of occupying public space and holding on to it until your demands are met. Right. Was a wonderful example of the Tahrir Square movements. Yeah.
And that the tools that are typically used to create change don't work. You know, we need new tools. And
like writing your congressperson?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And of course, these are not new tools. There have been occupations throughout history. This is a common. We always saw it as a tactic, not actually the movement. But
right.
Because it kind of took on a life of its own, which the Indignados had warned us about. They said, really, you don't want to hold the space for too long because then it becomes all about holding the space and you're using so much resources to hold that.
I saw that happening in a lot of places. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, but once you kind of created it, you know, because we were operating, you know, by a consensus model, and we were so ripe for infiltration, and we were heavily infiltrated. And so,
of course,
which we documented some of. Afterwards.
Oh, good. Can you talk about that a bit? Because this is something that a lot of people have dealt with, and but they often just are not expecting it. People just think, oh, I'm not important enough to be infiltrated. I mean, there's a tiny little peace group in Fresno, California, that, you know, because one of their members was an undercover cop who died in a motorcycle accident, and his obituary, said he was a cop, and then they realized, oh, he was a cop, you know. Yeah. But I mean, the infiltrators, you know, when Peter Camejo ran for governor of California in the 1970s.
Right.
He did a FOIA, FOIA thing.
He was in court.
But he found out that from the FOIA application, he found out that half of his campaign volunteers had been either infiltrators or, assets, you know.
I always heard that story differently because Kevin actually worked for Camejo when he ran with Ralph
Nader. Oh, you know what? I might have heard the story from Kevin. So whatever story you've heard is probably closer to the truth.
Their offices were broken into, and they were able to get into court, and they got a federal agent in court. And then the judge or someone asked him, how many agents do you have in the campaign? And it was like 70 or something. And one of them was even the campaign co-chair. So, you know, the common wisdom is kind of whatever resources you see them using overtly, they're probably using a similar amount of resources covertly. And so infiltration of social movements in the U.S. has been something that goes on. I think, was it the DNC protest in Chicago in 68, where 1 in 6 of the protesters were actually, I think, federal agents? Or, you know, so we were really prepared, trying to prepare for that and prepare people in Freedom Plaza.
Right.
Prevent infiltration there.
And what forms did the infiltration take? What kind of role did the infiltrators try to play?
Well, so really common things that they do is they try to take over the media. They volunteer. So the best infiltrators are ones that make themselves indispensable to you. They volunteer. They help out. They will film this, or I'll do your website, or I'll run your social media. And then, of course, what we found around the various occupies is that they were deleting video that people wanted to use in court. Deleting websites, kicking people out of social media. They create division. So they're really good at kind of just like looking at the dynamics in the group and then knowing who they can kind of push to create some chaos and division and money. So fear, you know, mistrust and fear. So a big one is getting people to question how the money is being used and
making false accusations.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Kevin and I were under personal attack, you know, on in Occupy, and the things that they were coming up with were just like so incredible. And we, you know, at first you respond and you're like, well, that's not true, and then they come up with another more outrageous lie, and you understand that there's no interest in actual truth here. It's just, what can we do to personally smear you? So
but when they get to a certain point of outrageousness, then that makes it harder for them to be taken seriously, I imagine. So they have to probably have some level of some kind of possible sounding accusation, right?
There's always a kernel of truth, you know, and everything, but then they manipulate it and, you know, say things. So that's just pretty typical. And I think that out of that, you know, consensus works when you are a united group with a common purpose. You know, it doesn't work in this kind of really open format with anybody can walk in,
right,
and have an equal say and just like throw things off. But I think that was one of the lessons we learned in Occupy.
Right. Yeah, it seemed like in a lot of the Occupy camps at the beginning, the kind of like efforts to make consensus work and the kind of like a really, really expert facilitation of meetings that I saw going on in some places was really quite something. And that kind of started falling apart over time.
Yeah.
But it also seemed like it was often, at least at a lot of the camps I saw, I wasn't like trying to keep a track, but there was so many of the best facilitated meetings were being facilitated by oftentimes I noticed like women in their 30s with a background in small business who didn't necessarily have any background in this kind of activism, who just like somehow knew how to just fly into action. It was really so many people coming out of the woodwork who just had no background in this kind of thing, who just did so well at it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, in early on, it was really amazing. It was very powerful. And yeah.
What made you decide to run for office a few years later yourself? And why did you decide to run for the Senate instead of like a local office?
Well, so there was an open Senate seat in Maryland, and Chris Van Hollen was running for it. And he has this kind of veneer of being a progressive in Maryland, and he's really not progressive at all. I mean, he raised like the most money for his Senate campaign, and you know, all these corporate lobbyists, and his parents were CIA and State Department, and he's a big militarist. And so I was asked to run by the Maryland Green Party, and I thought, well, this will be a good opportunity to push Van Hollen and kind of hopefully have a platform to raise some of these issues, and also to really kind of try to build the party up. So we had a really great year and a half in that campaign because we had a lot of people running. We had a great candidate running for mayor in Baltimore City, and lots of people running for the city council and Congress in Maryland. And so we kind of were able to have this platform and build up our Green Party chapters in the state. And I just think that we need, you know, it's kind of hand in hand with the political movement, is having some sort of a party that has the platform that is, you know, companion to the social movement. And I felt like building up that, you know, party was probably the best. The Green Party has the most ballot access for a national left party in the United States. And it seems like it's an opportunity to use that. People would take it. You know, people keep saying, well, you know, create it and then I'll come to it. And then I keep saying, no, actually, this is a structure. And if you come into it, we can strengthen it and make it stronger. But it's
but did you constantly come confront this whole mentality around the lesser evil being the way that the system has to work here? And or I mean, that's always the problem with our winner take all system of democracy here in the U.S.
Well, people always say those things. And we know historically that third parties have been part of social change, you know, throughout the history of our country. And my sense is, how can you spoil something that's already rotten, you know? But right. What's interesting is that in my campaign, I ran into the, you know, media censorship, not being included in debates. And so I ended up crashing a couple of debate stages.
Excellent.
And one of them was the only televised debate where they had invited me in and they disinvited me. Oh. And for 2 months we were pressuring to get into that televised debate and they refused. And so we went down there on the day of, and amazingly I was able, well, Kevin did a distraction action. And I'd already talked to both of the candidates, the Republican and Democrat, on camera about would they support me being in the debate, and they said yes. So when I walked on the stage and got on and said who I was and why I'm here, one of the candidates was like, let's get her a podium and include her. And instead they called the police and dragged me off. And that opened a lot of people's eyes. And after that, everywhere I went, everybody was like, oh, you're the one who went up there, you know, and did that. And
did they cover your arrest on the media?
Yes, they did. They did. There were two cameramen right there that followed me all the way out, and I was giving a speech.
Great.
You start to learn that when you've got a camera, you have to use it. So,
yeah, right.
So that was probably one of the most powerful parts of that campaign. And also, I just traveled the whole state, and I went to the parts of the state where people never go. And people were so, you know, happy to see someone there. And I learned so much about our communities in this state. It was really amazing.
Did you feel like the kind of organizing that you were doing, running for office, was something that could be used for other things later in terms of building popular resistance and that sort of thing?
I don't know about it helping with building popular resistance, because it's kind of a different
right.
kind of a thing. And Kevin really had to hold it down during that time. So that's a struggle. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of work to keep Papres going. But I mean, we did do a lot of political education, and we had all the Occu cards that we had made during Occupy that teach people about different things. We were handing those out everywhere we went on the campaign. So we're definitely trying to do popular, you know, political education out there.
Right.
During it.
Dr. Flowers, thank you so much for joining me for the hour. And there's about a million other things to talk about, but we'll do it again sometime soon, I hope. And okay. Be great. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Take care. And oh, but one more thing. Online things that people can tune in on coming up in the next few days on Popular Resistance or anything else you're doing?
We're actually doing a webinar this Saturday on connecting the dots between climate change and militarism. So
where will that be? They can go to popularresistance.org.
It's on our Facebook page, we're on our Facebook page. There's an event there. And it's, oh gosh, I'm forgetting the bit.ly that I made. It's something like climate war. Anyway,
it's on there. Events coming up this Saturday.
Yeah. And that's, yeah.
Awesome. Excellent. Thank you. See you soon.
Yep.
And thank you all for tuning in to another discussion with David. Tomorrow, if he can get a decent signal out there in the Cooley Mountains, I'll be talking with another of my favorite people who grew up surrounded by the tanks and burning barricades of Ardoyne, brilliant musician, engineer, producer, hunter, butcher, chef, and expert marksman, Paul McAdam. On Friday, I'll spend the hour entertaining the labor activists of Canada and anybody else who tunes in to the main Facebook page of MayWorks, a network that promotes the music of the labor movement across Canada. If you want to help support my musical and live streaming efforts during this period where all of us touring musicians cannot tour, this would be most appreciated. I'm spending all of my disposable income these days on printing rent strike posters, and this is getting expensive, so your donations are welcome, and that's where they'll be going. You can make a one-off donation at paypal.me/DavidRovix or become a repeat offender by joining my community-supported art program, which you can read about at davidrovix.com/subscribe or at patreon.com/DavidRovix. That's all for now. See you again soon here in the Matrix and sometime soon afterwards back out in the streets. Mutual aid will get us through. Don't pay the rent.